You went through all the vows, learning all the vows, and this is the last class, so what do you think it's about?
Why?
How to keep them. So tonight we're going to talk about how to keep them. The first point in learning how to keep them, by the way, they're working on the roof, so you're going to hear a lot of banging tonight. Don't worry about it. Might be 9. It doesn't get too hot.
Turn it easy.
You want that
fire?
Okay, if it gets too warm, let me know. I'll turn it up higher. There are basically 5 steps to keeping the vows. Okay, 5 different steps that you could take to try to keep your vows well. Say, Sungla.
Sungla.
Kupa.
Kupa.
Sungla.
Sungla.
Kupa.
Kupa.
Sung means speech, but here it means the speech of the Buddha. Something that the Buddha himself taught. La means to, T-O. Gupa means respect. Summa Gupa means to respect the speech. And what it means is this.
Of the Buddha?
Yeah. To respect the speech of the Buddha. What it means is this. If you're going to keep the vows very well, the very first step, according to a Sangha and according to Jetsu Kapa, is that you have to... You know, right now, your viewpoint of those vows that we went over, you know, we went over them for weeks, and you went over the 64 vows, and now, how do you, when you think about those vows, what do you think of? You know, do you think they were written by some guy in India a couple hundred years, you know, like 1600 years ago? Are you thinking, when I say who wrote the vows, what pops into your head? Do you see a Sangha sitting there and saying, well, maybe we better have a vow against this, and maybe we better have a vow against that? What comes into your mind? It's really the Buddha, okay? The point is that, and you can read it in the text, the point is that every one of these vows was spoken by the Buddha. He did not speak them in one place at one time. He gave them at different places at different times. And then it was a Sangha's job who was being coached by
Maitreya,
who is
Buddha.
He's already a Buddha, actually. That he was... Maitreya was coaching a Sangha on how to write them out. But the Sangha didn't write the vows. I mean, he assembled them from the Buddha's own speech. So you have to look at the vows.
Is that both a Sangha and Tsongkhapa are being instructed by Maitreya?
Well, Jetsu Kapa, according to tradition, was coached by Manjushri.
In this case?
Yeah, even... Well, just generally. Yeah. But when you look at the vows, you have to think of them as written by a person or spoken by a person to help you personally, because the Buddha can see your mind. 2,500 years ago, when the Buddha sat down on the grass in India and started teaching these vows, he had you in mind. Each person here, he could see your mind, and he could see your own life. He could see your own thoughts, and he spoke it knowing that you would learn it. So you have to look at it that way. That's the way the vows are. He knew that if you did these 64 things, you could reach, in this life, before you die, you could reach some kind of paradise. Today, at my work, everyone was very religious. All the Indian people were talking about nirvana and the future life and the past life, because... On Sunday, there was a large van of Indian diamond dealers, and a guy in a Porsche ran into them going 100 miles an hour and killed all of them, except for one girl. And then she was at the funeral today, you know, and her mother's still alive, but she's like, and they're afraid to tell her that all her family's dead. So everyone at work was crying. They all went to the funeral today. And just in one stroke, like, 3 of the most important business people in my industry were wiped out. And all their sons and their kids and their wives. And so everybody was thinking about religion today. You know, it was very strange. If you want to do something in this life before you are, you know, before that happens, then you have to keep the vow. If you want to reach... some kind of safe place before that happens, you have to keep these vows. That's the way. There is no other way. You have to keep these vows. That's the way. And they work they will work and things will happen and you can reach a place of safety on them. Because of what?
What?
Because of karma. And then, but karma cannot operate if things weren't
empty.
Okay, because things are empty, karma can operate. What's the best way to force your karma is to keep these vows. Okay, so if you want to do anything about your life, you know, if you want to reach any kind of state in this life that's going to be some kind of protection or even like paradise, if you want to reach some kind of enlightened paradise before you die, and you don't know how long you have, you know, a guy in a Porsche might run into you tonight, you have to keep these vows. You have to know them and you have to keep them. So that, and you have to believe what I say, because it's not what Jetsongkhapa says and what Asanga says. Look, I didn't make these up. I'm just a messenger. You know, this is the Buddha knows our minds, and he said if you keep these 64, this will happen to you. Yeah.
What do you mean by reaching an enlightened paradise? Because according to the Sutra, you can't do that.
Excuse me?
What do you mean by reaching an enlightened paradise before you die?
That's the whole idea. Right?
According to Tantra, you can do that, but not according to Sutra.
I don't know anything about Tantra, but according to Sutra, you can do it.
What, in one
3 years,
lifetime?
3 months, 3 days.
Huh? In one lifetime?
Sure.
Where did that come?
I'll show you. I'll show you in secret. No. Anyway,
isn't that attitude engendered even in the sutra? They don't say forget about it. It's going to take you a million lifetimes. Even if you just practice sutra, it's over and over again. Emphasize you should practice with the intention.
Well, anyway, next question. But don't take your mind off that. The point is, keep them perfectly in this life, and see what happens. How's that? You check and see if we can do it.
In a way, you're implying that the karma, the kind of karma that you collect by keeping your vows, falls into the category of karma that rises in this life?
Absolutely.
Okay.
What if you keep 64 vows?
If you keep your 64 vows, it's just greasing the wheels very, very nicely for seeing it. So I think they feed each other. You know, they are symbiotic. And if you keep them very, very well, I have to think that you would, it'd be hard. I mean, you would become very, very right. And if you don't keep them very well, you won't become right. But you must see it to reach that place in this life. That's true. So that's Sunagopa. So the point is, before anything is done, you have to look on these vows as a gift from the Buddha himself to you directly, personally. You know, he's talking to you, Edwin, Miranda, you know. If you keep these 64, you will have all the extraordinary experiences you can imagine and more. Things you never dreamed of, you know. But, and if you don't keep them, or if you keep them sort of half-heartedly, you'll get a half-hearted reaction. And you won't see many amazing things. And then when that happens in 5 years from now, don't blame me, okay? And don't blame Asanga and Maitreya. Check your vows, you know? If life is getting blah blah in 10 years from now, you know, check your vows.
Can you elaborate what you mean by amazing?
They say temporal and ultimate goals, you know? I mean, in a temporal sense, everything you ever dreamed of and things you can't even think of now. And in an ultimate sense, of course, paradise. But what's that? You're not going to have any bad karma.
Dreamed of are necessarily worthy.
I mean, but if we had done something, you know, yes. That was particularly...
No, you have to do your confessions. You have to clean them. That's the whole idea of the fourfold karma.
Yeah.
Yes.
But it still has to fruition somehow. So even if you're practicing,
little headache.
You do a lot of nasty things.
Little headache. If you do a good confession.
Unless you just read the Diamond Sutra,
then. Yeah, it's in the Diamond Sutra.
Yes, well, that's different.
Okay. If you get that... So that's the first step. I mean, he's trying to tell you how to succeed in your Bodhisattva vows. First is, try to perceive those vows as a gift to you personally from an enlightened being.
Sutra.
Sapa Sutra.
Sapa Sutra.
Okay. Sapa means intentions. Some means three. So there's three intentions here. If you think that these vows are something that karmically you have come across because this enlightened being has been trying to make contact with you and finally made contact and then gave you these vows into your mind stream, you would naturally want to keep them. You would start to think, oh, I'd like to follow these. I'd like to keep these vows. You would start to think that. That's one of the intentions.
You mean you intend to follow the vows because of that?
Yeah. I mean, if you realize that some enlightened being has reached across the centuries and given you these vows, hopefully the next thought in your mind would be, well, I better keep them. And then why? To reach Buddhahood. I mean, there's lots of other goals. Most people have... The Kadampas used to say, think big. You know, the Kadampas used to say, don't limit your goals. You know, think big. Think, I want to be a Buddha in this life. I want to become a totally enlightened being in this life. I want to be a person who can sit on 39th Street and 9th and have, you know, help limitless numbers of sentient beings there. And, you know, don't limit your aspirations. You know, think that in this lifetime, you would be extraordinary being, and that you'd be able to help other people in an ultimate way. So imagine that, because you can. You will. You think like that. Think big. Don't think wimpy. You'd be like, I can imagine some people being like you read in, not to bring in another religion, but like when you're reading about Jesus walking along the seashore and saying, you know, hey, come on, let's go. You know, leave that boat. And just go. Go and strive for something higher. You know? And they just give. They just drop what they're doing and go. That, I imagine that you could imagine like that. That you could reach a point in this life where you could help sentient beings that efficiently, because you can reach it. Third thing, I mean, set your goals on that. That you could actually help limitless numbers of living beings. Now, I had that experience at work today. A lot of the people, they went to the funeral, they came back, they were crying, and then they wanted to talk. So who are you going to talk to? You know, is it going to be the quality control supervisor? Or not? You know what I mean? So they were coming and they were asking religion questions because that's renunciation. We call it goosebump renunciation. Because it goes away in about a day. Tibetans call it a Nyenjin Pusu. It means it lasts about as long as a goosebump. But it means for a few hours, people's minds is in the right place, the place where it should be all the time, which is, gee, this could happen to me. That could have been my daughter, 11-year-old daughter, at the funeral. And they're videotaping it so they can show the mother when she finds out that everyone's dead. You know, they're afraid to tell her, so they're videotaping it, you know. And then she's like, they're all thinking this could have been my kid at my funeral, you know. And so they all have questions about, you know, karma today, you know, that are going to go away tomorrow. So you can help those people. You can help people like that. You know, you can have something to offer them. Right now, if you don't know the system, and then if you haven't practiced it or experienced it, then what do you have to offer? If you reach this kind of enlightenment, you could, anyone who came up, anyone who was ready, you could give them exactly the right thing they need at the right time. So that would be something extraordinary to be able to do that. Dombalang means to, Domba means your vow. Lang means to take them. And this is supposed to be the normal process. I mean, first you hear the vow, and you start to conceive of them as a gift from the holy being to you personally. Then you start to have these three different thoughts. Hey, if I kept them, I could reach paradise. And then all those people around me who are suffering and helpless, I could actually help them. I could actually teach them, or I could show them what to do. So based on that, I will take the vows. You decide, I want to take the vows, and you take them. You can't keep them until you take them. Okay. The next step after that.
So, Dombalang is number four?
Yeah.
What is
three.
Yeah, and what is that exactly?
Take the vows.
Take them. The vows.
Okay. I mean, there's probably, and by the way, if there's a group of people who want to take them, Hopefully. We'll try to get Rinpoche to agree to give them maybe in November or something. December. Say Choktu.
Choktu.
Gupa.
Gupa.
Choktu Gupa.
Choktu Gupa.
We had Gupa already. What was it? Do you remember?
Respect.
It was respect. Choktu means as the highest thing. Choktu means as the highest thing. So it means to respect as the highest thing. I mean, for a moment, put your mind on the most precious possession you have. I mean, if I ask you, I mean, mine is my laptop, right? but if somebody asks you, you know, what's the most precious thing you have? You know, what's the most precious thing you own? I mean, anybody?
Your life.
I mean, a lot of people would think their own life, right? She's thinking Bodhi, right?
I'm thinking, I know it's not supposed to be.
Her daughter, right?
Your mama.
The point here is that it's your vows. Now you own the vows, okay? And it's very proper to feel very possessive. And you should be like my boss counting his millions, you know? I mean, this should be the thing that you go home and you enjoy the fact that you own it. And every night you count your vows up. You say, oh man, you know, I'm rich. I got all these vows, you know. There's like 199 million Americans. They only have all these vows. I got vows. You know?
And really. And breaking one if you think of all
that.
What?
All
these people don't have it and I do.
Yeah. What I mean is, be a little bit, it's precious. Those are this number four means when you, I mean, right now you think it's sort of interesting, mildly beneficial, you know, something you probably would like to keep if you have time in the morning, but if you don't, well, you can do it the next day. And, I mean, but the point here is to start to think of the vows in your own mind stream as the most precious possession that you own. You own them. And they are the most precious thing you have, because that's the closest you can get to pure paradise. That's your gateway, that's your door, that's your key. That's the only way you're going to get there. You know, now you have it. Now you learned all those vows. You know, if you took them, then you possess them, and then you, out of all the millions of people in the world, you're among that tiny percentage that actually has the instructions on how to reach this holy place, this paradise. You know? And you own that. That's part of you now. You possess that. So you got to be very... you should look on that as the most precious thing you own, is your vows. You know, Rinpoche is very fond of saying when you go to a tantric initiation and the Lama gives you vows, it's not a punishment. You know, it's not like the Lama is saying, let's see, how can I complicate your life, you know? How can I make you miserable? I give you all these vows that you can't keep, you know? It's not like that. It's a great gift. And he says, he calls them your helpmate. You know, they are like your dear friend. And they're trying to help you. They're trying to get you somewhere. So you have to look on them as something very, very precious that you own. And think about them all the time. Think about them. I mean, how often does my boss think about his $150 million in diamonds? You know? I imagine he thinks about them constantly and enjoys the thought of them. And you can enjoy it the same way your vows. You have something much more precious. You have something infinitely more precious. So enjoy it and think about it. You got them. And you got this method now to get to some kind of incredible place. And very few people ever get there. See, that's Choktu Gupa. Yeah.
Somebody else, when you said, what's the most precious thing, somebody else said, Lama, your Lama.
Lama is more important than your vow.
There you go.
But
is that why? Can you make some connection, relationship, or say something more about that?
They say specifically, and I can tell you this, it's in the tantric text, but I can tell you because it's not a secret. Because that's your only liaison with the Buddha. That's your only window to the enlightened realm. You know, is the speech of that person. That person may or may not be a Buddha, but for all intents and purposes, that is the Buddha. Because they communicate the Buddha's words to the person who learns them. So that's the proof in the tantric textbooks that your lama is a Buddha. So that's all. Okay. Number five. Say Mingyawa.
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 If you're wondering about the na, it's the prenasal from the Mingyaw. If anybody cares. Okay. Mingyawa means not to break your vows. It means now you keep them. Keep them. Keep your vows. What's the connection between thinking it's the most precious thing you own and then wanting to keep them? I mean, not wanting to break them. Let's say that you're my boss, right? He's having a bad year this year. He's late on all his payments, like the Suraj Diamond Company, which he works for now. You know, I mean, he's first, I think for the first time he's having some kind of a perception that he might lose the diamonds, you know what I mean? That they are not self-existent, you know, that they could be lost, you know. And so he will undertake any activity he can in order not to lose them, because he does perceive them as, supposedly, we don't know his mind, right? He does perceive them as the most precious thing that he owns. So naturally, human nature is, you want to protect them from losing them. So what's the connection between four and five? It's the same thing. I mean, if you break them, you lose them. If you break a root vow with the four chains, okay. Except in the case of, this is how my lama teaches in Sarah. Yeah, in separate cases. He's like a Baptist minister. I have a scripture teacher. He's like, except for number 918, which are, first one is, what? Long view, okay. And the second one is, losing your bodhisattva, giving up on sentient.
So the relationship with the four or five is the same thing?
It's the same thing as my boss, you know. You see it as the most precious thing you own. So you do what you have to do to keep them, which is you don't break them.
It looks like bright side of persistence.
I think it's, yeah. Yeah. One of my lamas used to say, you can use all those bad thoughts if you just make them into positive energy, you know. He said, be jealous of your fellow students because it will drive you. And then it will drive you to get over your jealousy of your fellow students. Okay, so those are the five. You can see how that process goes. And if you think about it, you'll see how it goes. Sooner or later, if you want to keep your vows, those five ideas are going to have to come into your mind. So all those five attitudes are going to have to be there for you to keep your vows well. And they will help you keep your vows. Let me see what's next on your homework here. This question here says, can a person... Oh, I know what it was. Now, Jeffrey Kaufman here, he gets into how to confess when you break your vows. And when you break your secondary, especially, because there's no use confessing that. I mean, if you're going to restore the vows, you're only talking about the secondary vows. Because if you break the root vows, you lost them already. No use to... By the way, it's very good to confess them, but if you broke them with all those things, you don't actually have them anymore. You have to take them over. But when he talks specifically about confessing the secondary vow, he's talking, a question comes up, and somebody says, some Tibetans of the past were saying, if you break a vow out of, like, forget, you just forget yourself. You're not doing it on purpose, right? You just forget that you have that vow, and you kind of slip and you break it. That kind of vow, some Tibetans in the past said, if you just in your mind vow not to do it again, you purify that and you restore your vow. And on the other hand, this is why when we talked about the secondary offenses, remember we said those that are caused by bad thoughts and those that are not caused by bad thoughts. The ones not caused by bad thoughts were like out of laziness or forgetfulness. You forgot you had the vow. Like let's say you forget to do an offering to one of the three gems during the day. Something like that. You know, you forget. You forget to honor them in body, speech, and mind for 24 hours. You just forget. They said, well, that's so light that you can just purify it and restore your vow completely by mentally deciding not to do it again. And then those ones that you're caused by bad thoughts, like when you get angry or you want to hurt someone, those you have to repair by going to another human being and confessing to them. And the gentle kapha says, what do you get? Asanga never made that distinction. Asanga said there's no such distinction. Asanga said whether you break it out of forgetfulness or slipping, or whether you break it out of this horrible outburst of anger, same thing, you broke it. And you have to go confess it in front of a person. Since a person, if it's available, if the person is available, person is best if there's any kind of person available. Somebody asked me what kind of person is okay, and he finally gets into it at this point in his text. He quotes the Sangha, and as I read it, it says you can confess to either a Hinayana practitioner or a Mahayana practitioner, which seems to say the person does not have to have bodhisattva vows for you to confess to the person. But he does say, he does make a express the opinion that if you're ordained, if you're a monk or nun, and you're going to confess to somebody, it's preferable to confess to another ordained person if there's one available. So that's all he says about it. And he says the person to whom you confess, they have to understand what you're talking about. Like our neighbor has a child who's autistic. Now that's a human being, but if you confess to her, she doesn't know what you're talking about. She'll say, okay. You know. And I used to kind of do that. When I had something really bad, I would go to a Tibetan monk who didn't really understand what I was talking about. I mean, the person that you confess to has to totally understand the gravity and the whole situation, and, you know, you have to express it in a way that they really grasp what you did. I mean, when it comes time, I warn you, you will waffle. You know, you'll try to make it look better than it was. And you have to catch yourself and get it all out, you know. Don't, like, change the subject before it's all out. You know, I'm just telling you from experience, you know. When I go to Rinpoche and I have something bad to confess, you know, I usually chicken out about halfway through and try to get him distracted, you know. So, you know.
Breaking another
vow. Yeah, yeah. Or you'll find that you break vows, like, within 5 minutes after you confess them. But you have to... But the confession game is very pure. It makes you very pure, and you have to get into that game. You have to learn how to do it. Start. Find somebody close to you who can grasp what you're talking about, and tell them frankly the things that you do. And you'll find that your practice will get much better, and you'll start to have those experiences that I won't talk about. Okay. Here. And they don't happen if you don't do it. Okay, get good at it. You know, take it it's hard the first few times, and then if you have a good partner or two, you start to improve, and they start to improve, and it becomes a pleasure to sit and list your. You know, we did one the other night. It took like 2 hours and 2 years list. We finally got tired. We didn't run out of that, dude. I think it helps because you have to track them, right? It's like production in your factory, you know?
Do you do what Catholics do, make a general confession?
We have a general confession. I handed it out once. I don't know. Somebody might have a copy. I think still won't probably have a copy. There is a general confession.
Took my vows a year ago, and I haven't done any confessions.
Here's a very general one that you can do.
I'm doing one now. Oh, crazy. Michael, it seems like a very dangerous thing to me to confess to somebody. Because it seems like you have to have a tremendous trust. You have to know the person really, really well, like for years and years and years. Know that, A, they're not going to go and tell everybody. B, they're not going to think you're weird.
Well, they have to know what's going on. They have to be preferably a discreet person. But what if everyone in the world knew you did that? I mean, so? Maybe you're just the most intelligent person in the world to tell the world who you really are. What if everyone knew all your bad deeds? I mean, this was this thing at work I had where I had this... I'm supposed to supply diamonds to the factory manager, and I had this really terrible factory manager for a while. And he used to blame me for every minor problem in supplying the diamonds So one day it occurred to me that if I just supplied them perfectly, I wouldn't get any complaints. So if you don't like your dirty laundry getting out, just clean it, and then you have to worry about it.
Did it work?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think a Buddhist, obviously you have to be discreet, and obviously you don't want to, you don't want to be one of these people who goes and confesses to everybody, and it doesn't really mean it anyway, and just wants everyone to know the terrible things they've done. It's not the point. The point is to do it with someone with whom, I would say my experience is someone that you highly respect. Like, I do it with Rinpoche. So you don't want to tell it to someone unless you really have the intention to stop. And it should be embarrassing. And Jetsul Kapa says it works because you're embarrassed.
The embarrassment method is very
very good. That's what debating's about in monks. You get in front of 500 monks and say something stupid. But it works. And he says the reason a person is better than imagining all the Buddhas and confessing to them is that you'll be embarrassed. And you'll be ashamed. And that's good. But yeah, but to confess everything in front of the most indiscreet person who's going to embellish it and then spread it around, and you know that kind of person, don't do it. Don't. That's not saying it. Don't do it.
Isn't that also breaking a vow? You're not supposed to be exposing things about yourself that can be used against you to make you look like a bad bodhisattva.
Yeah, like that. My experience is that the people whom you really want to confess to, because they are someone that you consider kind of holy, are not the type to spread it around anyway. Yeah.
What type of detail is required?
You can read it. It's at the end of your reading. Geshe Tsewang Samdrup gives a confession. He writes one there. It's pretty long. I would say, take the middle part of it and use that. But he says, I, so-and-so, I have committed, and then you fill in the blank, And he actually has a formula there. So I put it there, And but, I mean, once you get used to doing it, you'll work it out. You'll know what to say. And the main thing is that it's sincere and that you really don't intend to do it again for a certain time limit at least.
And somehow you say that the person you are confessing to is supposed to not review it? Like, for example, a Catholic priest cannot do it even in the court.
I don't recall that it's mentioned as a big... I don't recall that... I haven't seen that mentioned anywhere. That they can't reveal it or they can't tell anybody anything. But I know by lineage, by tradition, they don't. The tradition of the lineage is that we don't. We don't. So that's sort of more of a tradition of our lineage. Especially like if monks are confessing things to each other, they don't tell other people. Just by tradition. One more question.
I had gotten the idea that when you become a bodhisattva, then you no longer have a private life, so you're not really trying to keep your life secret. I mean, maybe you won't reveal things that are going to do harm, either to yourself or to somebody else, but you're not really trying to keep your doing secret.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, that's what I started out by saying. I think what if everyone in the world knew all your worst faults? I mean, probably you just want to work harder to clean them up. So maybe you should appear to be what you are. Maybe that's the most easy thing to do. Maybe that's the most efficient way to live, is to show people what you really are. And then if you don't like it, then improve it. Okay. We'll do one more point. There's five factors that make a deed more or less serious. There's a section in the text, and he says, are there certain kinds of ways of breaking your vows that are more serious or less serious? And then he gets into five different factors. So we'll go through those five factors. This is very good. Okay. So the first one is by instigator, okay? I mean, what made you do it? The devil made me do it.
What are these?
These are, I'm going to give you five different factors that make it more or less serious when you break. When you break your vows. And you'll get the idea after I do a few of them.
Okay.
But the first one is, what was the instigator? If you break a vow with the following instigator, it's the lightest. Less serious. Not knowing, comma.
Comma, you said?
Comma.
Oh, comma.
Bad comma and comma.
Please, okay?
Least serious. What does not knowing mean? Mishepa, what does it mean? Not knowing what?
That you're breaking the
You don't know your vows, okay? I mean, that's the least serious. If you break, you took bodhisattva vows from some lama who came through town one night, you have no idea what they are, you were there at the initiation, you got your bodhisattva vows, and then you break it the next day because you don't even know what they are, okay? I mean, Jetsam Kapa gives two examples. Either you never heard them, you know, the lama never explained all 64, or there was some short explanation and you didn't really get it. You know, like you heard the names of the vow, but you never understood what it meant. Then you're in this category. If you break the vow that way, do you break it?
Yes.
You break it. But it's a little bit better, okay? It's a little less serious karmically, okay? It's better than if you knew very clearly what the vows were, which is unfortunately the condition you're in now.
What if you learned it and you forgot?
Try to forget it, yeah.
Does that make you
the instigator now? Careless means you forgot, you know, you were busy, and you were distracted, you didn't get a full night's sleep. It wasn't so bad as a what's a klesha? A bad thought, okay? Jealousy, anger, pride, desire, ignorance.
Are these in order from less to worse?
Yeah, these are from least serious to most serious. All serious, but less serious than most serious. Secondly, B is where, I mean, it's defined in the text as, you know, you're just overcome by a bad thought, you know? You're jealous of somebody at work, you're jealous of a fellow translator, and you it takes over your mind for, you know, 5 minutes, and you break your vow. That's medium serious. It's called medium serious.
How could you break a vow if you didn't have a klesha attack?
You just forget to make offerings.
Yeah, that, okay.
Okay. Alright, C is the worst one. Disrespectful, what do you think? The vow, yeah. Watch out for that. I mean, that's like, yeah, I know I'm supposed to make an offering every day, but, you know, maybe it's kind of a stupid vow, anyway. Yeah, I feel like I do it every other day. I know I'm not supposed to yell back at somebody who yells at me. I know that's part of my bodhisattva class, but, you know, they really did. They were really mean. It wasn't like just a normal yelling. It's really bad. Probably I got the worst one in the company today, you know. And everyone believes that, right? Everyone believes that the yelling they got was much worse than anyone else's. And so they were okay to yell back. And that's Magupa. Magupa means you just don't treat the vows very seriously. You think they're not very important. You think it's mildly interesting and virtuous, but not something you're going to be a fanatic about.
Disrespect meaning just not holding them in high regard.
There's 9 different kinds of disrespect and they're in your reading. But you can imagine basically what it is you just don't think it's very important. And we have to be very careful about that. You have something very precious. Learn them, keep them, think about them all. It's like getting a new girlfriend, okay? It's like meeting Mr. Right, you know? I mean, if you went home after meeting Mr. Right, it'd be on your mind all night long. I don't think your bodhisattva vows are on your mind all night long. But it's the same thing. You got something very, very special. And you should be like, you know, fascinated and fixated on it. You know, boy, I got bodhisattva vows just for this. You know, you have bodhisattva vows. But you're not. You got to be careful.
Does that happen, Michael? That you do become that way? Like you're in, they become your lover?
Yeah, I think. Okay, we'll do one more. Let me see. Nah, we won't do one more. I'm tired. Take a break. Three poisons. That's the second thing that can make it serious or not serious. What are the three poisons?
Ignorance, hatred, and attachment.
There's all these words for it. You know, people say desire or greed. People say hatred. And then people say ignorance. And it's the three animals in the middle of the wheel of life that can. The pig, the snake, and a rooster. But what I think of desire, I think of, you know, overwhelming emotion from looking at Playboy magazine, or I think of hatred, I think of blowing into a fury and hitting someone. You know, I think of greed, I think of sitting with piles of money and rubbing your hands in them and stuff like that. I don't think they're very good translations. The definition of the first one is ignorantly not wanting to be parted from a certain object. You know, what it means is I prefer the word liking, which means ignorantly liking something. Not even as strong as attachment. This poison is in your mind all day long. This poison happens several times every few minutes. You know, what are you going to call it? It's the ignorant desire not to lose something. And it happens all day long. It happens every moment. It's where even those little feelings that you have that you like something. And I say ignorant because this is the state of mind that wants to keep something by protecting it. You see? And it's the natural human liking of an object. Because what it assumes is that you think you have to somehow protect the thing and defend the thing. Because really, what is the way you get the thing? What's the way to keep the thing? Is to give it. So it's any kind of instinct that every human has towards the things they like, that to keep this thing, I must protect it from others. And it's ignorant. It's basically, at its root, very stupid. It doesn't understand how things work. The way you keep things is to be generous with them. And the way you lose things is to fight off other people and try to protect it. So we act exactly the backwards. Human nature is backwards. That's liking. The three poisons are in your mind all the time. They're active constantly. So I don't like the word desire. I mean, I get desire maybe once a day, okay? But this poison is there all the time. That's why it's called poison. It's poisoning your mind all the time. It is dochak, which normally does mean, you know, attachment or desire. But if you go to the definition of this poison, you don't come up with that in English. It's not as strong as sitting there and rubbing your hands to your credit card, you know. It's, You and I know it is, but if I say, how many times today did you have desire? You would say a few times.
No, but if
you know,
said,
I was
how
in
many
the
times
store.
Today did I feel attachment? I would have to say all the time.
Maybe you could say that. But for me, attachment is even stronger. You feel attachment towards your husband, say? But do you feel attachment towards a cool breeze in this room?
When
which is what you would like
you
to have? What I'm trying to say is it's a constant coloring of your mind. It's a poisoning of your mind all day long. I think it's very dangerous to translate it as anger, or I'm sorry, desire or something like that. That's all. Okay, second one is what they translate as hatred or greed. But again, it's defined as wanting to be separated from an undesirable object in an ignorant way. Wanting to be separated from an undesirable object in an ignorant way. What does that mean? It means all day long, if you're a normal human being, things happen that you don't like. And you undertake steps to remove those things. You know, if your boss is yelling at you, I had it today, like all day, you know. You know, where are these diamonds, you know? Face kindly, where are these diamonds, you know? And you know, it's an undesirable object. Someone's screaming at you. But what do you do? What's the way to get out? How do you get rid of that object? You know, how do you you know.
Don't yell.
And the natural thing is to do something back, or to make an excuse, or to tell them to come back later, or anything you can do to get rid of the person. But that's not where they came from. And that's not how you're going to stop meeting people who are, oh, where's the thing, you know? It's not the way. It's not where they came from, and that's not how you're going to reach a place, a job, where everyone's like, hey, you know, that's great work you did, and you know, no problem. What I mean is, that's not where it comes from. If you don't like something, the ignorant human instinct is to fight against it, or to struggle, or to dislike it. And that's exactly how you're going to get it to
come back.
Come back. So this is the second poison. And it is a poison. Because it's making you do exactly the opposite thing. You should say, I'm glad to see you. I'm glad you're yelling at me. What would you like? You know, I'll try to get it for you. You know? And you just be very pleasant and positive. And actually, even if there were no such thing as Buddhism, it's the most efficient way to work anyway. It happens to work the best anyway. And then what was the third thing? It's the root of the first two. In the very ancient pictures of the Wheel of Life, in the best pictures, it's a pig with a rooster and a snake coming out of its mouth. It's not a circle. Because the source of those other two is not understanding the way things are. And that's ignorance. That's the third poison. The third poison makes the first two poisons happen. You just don't understand that if you don't like something, be good. And if you want to keep something, share it. So anyway, why do they say three poisons? What's this got to do with how serious the deed is? If you do a deed with light three poisons, it's not so serious. If you do it with medium strength three poisons, it's medium serious. And if you do it with heavy three poisons, it's heavy karma.
What does that mean?
You don't have to have all three. What it means is, I mean, when you're on the bus and you kind of like to have a seat, but somebody sits down before you, and you're just kind of like mildly irritated, but you go sit in another seat. That's light. But then if you're at work and you have a huge shouting match with somebody, and you think that's going to stop them from shouting at you, I would say that's a heavy duty. You see what I mean? It doesn't refer to which one of the three is heavier, and you don't have to have all three. Either one, any one, or combination. All right? Okay.
So what does it mean when they're light? The
karma is lighter. The bad deed is lighter. The breaking, your bodhisattva is lighter. Okay, object. In the text, they give the example of killing. By the way, the text at this section, Jetsun Kapa goes directly to Vinaya. He cops it all from the Vinaya. You know, it's actually all coming from the books about monks' morality. And he goes to the part about the object. And he says, a lighter object, they take the act of killing. Okay? A lighter object would be an animal. To kill an animal. So, relatively speaking, very serious, but among all the kinds of killing, lighter. Why? You haven't destroyed a potential for enlightenment in this life, normally. I mean, normally speaking, an animal doesn't have enough intellect that in this life they would understand all the things we've been talking about in this class and become enlightened in this life. It's very unlikely. It's almost impossible. So, I mean, you're not destroying a potential basis for nirvana and enlightenment in this life. You just can't understand all these things anyway. Yeah.
Do they make a distinction within the broad category of animal, insect versus what one animal to another, which is heavier or lighter, better or worse to kill?
I've seen a thing in the... There is a debate like that, and I don't remember how it works, but there's a debate about... There's some feeling that larger animals might feel more pain. And then there's a debate about, well, if you're eating it for meat, maybe it's better to kill a larger animal instead of 12 shrimp, you know, or, you know, there are debates like that. I don't quite remember how it came
about. Sweating insects versus, you know, whatever, killing a cow, you know.
All I've heard about is in quantity of food, you know, if you need 10 pounds of meat, you've got to kill one pig or five chickens, so better to kill one, you know what I mean? It's not, you know. Something like that. But
light is in terms of karma.
Karma, yeah, in breaking the balance.
An animal versus a person.
Yeah.
So applying that same reason of anyone who's the highest student or practitioner spiritually would be a heavier.
Much heavier.
Is that
C-H-A-K? Yeah, C-H-A-K.
What's that? There's going to be a subcategory here where we're talking about what the object's up to.
We got a light object already. I'm giving you a medium object. Okay? That's the second, that's the third way.
No, what I'm thinking is the story about Buddha in one of his lifetimes, I guess it was, having to make a decision to kill the captain of a ship to save hundreds of people or something.
It wasn't to save the people. It was to prevent the captain from going to the lowest house. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
It's interesting.
But then,
it was to protect the captain.
But the object is human, but do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, sure.
So is there a separate category where you talk about the activities that the object can
take? No, we're talking same deed, same motivation, different object. It, given a priori, deed is the same, motivation is the same. It's lighter if you kill an animal. Okay, that's all. Okay, second object. I want you to learn this word. Say miyam.
Miyam. Mirchakpa. Miyam.
Miyam. Mirchakpa. This is the object of a very serious type of killing. Mi means a human being. Am means or. Mirchakpa means a human fetus. Okay, a human embryo, a human fetus. In other words, according to Buddhism, They're equivalent, same thing. If you kill this or if you kill this, it's the same thing. Which clarifies the question of
abortion.
Okay. I mean, I was involved in when I was young, and I didn't know better. And it's a long story, but so just so you know, it's the same thing. Human being and a fetus are the same thing. According to Buddhism, the fetus starts at conception, the moment of conception. It's a mirchakpa. And this is quoted directly from the text. So remember it, and don't break it. You know, don't get involved in that. We have a big place in Connecticut. We can, they can stay there. Seriously, okay? It's a deal, okay? All right.
You're taking the sheep example to extreme.
Yeah.
Yeah. All
right, seriously. Okay, seriously. Right? And encourage other people to do it. All right. But not parent means, if you're talking about middle strength, okay, medium strength, not a parent means, you're not talking about a tamme, which is what? Those five? Yeah, you're not into one of those incredibly powerful karmas where you killed your father or you killed your mother. So that's called medium strength. Medium object. It's a human or a human embryo, which is very serious. But at least it's not your father or your mother. And what would be heavy duty? Killing your father and mother, okay? And that's object. That's from the point of view of object.
What about killing a llama?
Even worse. But we're just trying to keep the style consistent. If you want to know all the objects, you have to read the Abhidhamma. Fourth chapter. Accumulation means, just some complex explains it like this. Lesser accumulation would be to commit one, from one to five, of the breaking of vow, and not purifying it, not confessing it. That would be
one to five.
One to five. What?
Either one or two or three or four or five.
Of the steps?
No. Total accumulation. If you break either one or two or three or four or a total of five different secondary offenses, that would be, for example, less serious. By the way, this is all referring to Vinaya. It's probably referring to 253,000, you know, something like that. What he's trying to say is a certain small number would be considered less serious. Medium serious, he says, is a big number that you could still count. By the way, I believe that most Americans who have ever gotten bodhisattva vows are in the third category, which is why.
All broken.
No, they've broken many, many times, and they couldn't even tell you. They couldn't even count them. I mean, if they sat there all day and tried to figure out, since they got the vows at initiation in 1979 from so-and-so lama that came through town for that night, they couldn't even guess how many they had broken. And that's the most serious.
But the odds are good that they didn't have a clear understanding of what they were, and they might have even all been in Tibet and no one spoken in it.
That's a terrible thing. That's a terrible thing. It's unkind to give someone the vows under those. I mean, I think. But anyway, that opinion. I just spoke about it. Anyway, I take it back. very serious if you broke, if you shattered so many you can't even count them. Okay, that's accumulation. Number five.
Were they part of the color chakra initiation?
Yes.
Of course.
Yes.
Bad talk to Dolly.
How are you?
Missing one. Oh, I missed he doesn't state this one in the text, but he does later on. So I want you to bump all these down, okay? That was three, that was four. Sorry.
Uh-oh.
In number one paper, he does not list it in the text, but later on he mentions it.
So what becomes two
and
one?
Instigator becomes two?
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, this is one.
Yeah, I'm giving you a number one. You're number
page
one.
Nine.
Bump the rest of them down.
Page nine.
It's not my fault. He doesn't mention all of them here. Instigator is number two. Three points is number three. Object is number four. Accumulation is number five. Number one is nature. He does not explain it. I assume it means nature. Meaning this. I mean, just automatically, certain of the vowels are more important than the other ones. Which is what? Just their nature.
What?
Certain one of those 64 vowels are more serious than other ones of those 64 vowels. Which one? I believe that's what he's referring to. He does. He never states it directly. But before, you know, all through the text he's saying, the nature of the root vowels is that they're more serious than the secondary vowels. These five factors make it more or less serious when you break your vowels. And that's just comes from all the teachings of Abhidharma, all the teachings of Vinaya. And it's common sense, right? It's much more serious to kill your parents than to kill someone who's not your parents, and it's much more serious to kill a human being or a human creature than it is to kill an animal. And things like that. It's much more serious to break a vow out of a huge attack of anger than out of you never knew the vow.
What's the next thing on the
board, please? Really, the essence of this class tonight, which is the last, you know, new class, we'll have one review, is the following. Okay, it's four things that can make you break your vows. You better know these four. And we already mentioned them, but we'll do them formally. It's called the four causes of breaking your vows. If you want to be a great bodhisattva vow keeper, you better know these four. And the first one is, and we talked about it already. I mean, we've talked about all four of them. Jetokapa repeats them and he lists them. He says, you have to know. I mean, the first reason why anyone would break the bodhisattva vows is that they never learned them. They don't even know what they are. Or they heard them, you know, don't teach emptiness. But they never learned what it really meant. Things like that. What's the antidote for this?
Learn them.
He doesn't say learn them. He says, become a master of the vow. I mean, he's talking like, oh, number 14. No, I didn't do it today. But I did 13 yesterday, and number 12 I was thinking about the day before, and 16, 19, 25, 43. I was really close to yesterday. They call it Lodang. When you do Tunduk, that's supposed to be what you're doing. Tunduk is called a Lodang. It means like, hey, I didn't do 1, I did 5, I did number 7, didn't do 13, 14, I was a little weak today, 25. No. And I'll tell you, by personal experience, you can't do that. You can't reach that. Concentrate on two or three a day. You know, rotate them once a day, or rotate them every 3 days. Where's Brady? Where's the thing? Okay.
You don't have a class.
But it's got to... There's no way you can go through 64 vowels and then 7 other ones and 4 plus 4, right? And then you got to do your chanting vowels, you got to do your pranayama. I got to learn practice 52 pranayama vowels. So you pick what you can handle for a day, you know. Go through, take one or two each day, concentrate on it. It's my personal experience that that's the only way you can really do it. Otherwise, you'll go crazy. Okay, number two. That's like you just forget to do something you're supposed to do. Or you just get distracted. You know all those. Lazy, careless, forgetful. Okay? It's not intentional, it's not mean, it's not bad. But you will break a vow. What's the antidote for that? Huh? Yeah, they call it remembering and mindfulness.
But if you're only doing three each time, then it's sort of easy to forget.
That's true. I mean, the ones that require you to do something every day, you better You better have done it. You have this checked off on Brady's card. Until it becomes second nature. By the way, the practice of Tundra, actually doing Tundra, fulfills most of your life. That's one of the points. Okay, remembering and mindfulness. Keeping your mind on this. This is like what's going to happen tomorrow because you had your last Bodhisattva vow class. And then what's going to happen 3 months from now, you know, and they're not fresh in your mind anymore and you didn't exactly work very hard at them and then a few of them slip your mind. I mean, right after you get them the first time, which is most of you heard this detailed explanation for the first time, you'll be very careful. And then you'll get sloppy the second time you hear them the third time. It's very dangerous. It's called Dharma overload, you know. And in Tibet it's called Cheptok. And you... not as effective the second and third time that you hear it. This is your big chance. Most people either make it or break it on the first time they hear it. You have to try to stay mindful from tonight. There's no reason why it should happen later if not tomorrow. It's not logical. It won't be fresh.
Again?
It's not a joke. You know, I worked very hard on how to translate it, and it's exactly what it means. I mean, there's a long description about the bad thought growing in your mind, taking over your mind, fulfilling the majority of your mind, and then you do the thing. It just sounds like an attack to me. You know? The antidote is to identify the worst one and then work on it. The antidote for number 3, which is having these attacks every once in a while, you know what they are. Some people it's food, some people it's anger, some people it's jealousy, whatever. You know your own worst one. Probably only you really know for sure. And then work on, he says, attack that one first. Go for that one first. And that will, you'll be able to stop klesha attacks that way.
Did you say food the first one?
Excuse me?
Did you say food?
Yeah. I mean excessive. I mean like where it becomes a bad deed. It's actually, if you are obsessive about food in that way, Which Bodhisattva vow does it break? It's interesting. It's like looking at girls in the porn story.
I have no idea.
It's the one about ruining your meditative state of mind. It's the one about not seeking the meaning. It's the one about... There were 5 obstacles to keeping a meditative state of mind. And one was attraction to the objects of the senses. It just... not only in conjunction with your meditation, but he said, remember he said in your whole day, you know, if you want to keep some kind of a yogi's state of mind, you have to avoid being obsessive with the objects of the senses. You have to, that will ruin your ability to meditate well, and it will also ruin your stability of your consciousness for the whole day. I mean, if you give yourself up to one of the 5 objects of the senses, you damage your ability to concentrate and meditate.
So I mean somebody's overweight, a little bit overweight, and stress, and he's out of stress? No. Breaking the vow?
So wherein does the enjoyment of your karmic fruits come?
No, I'm not talking about that. And you know the difference. When the Dalai Lama laughs at a joke, when the Dalai Lama eats dinner, when Rinpoche has something he enjoys to eat, you know, he's not... It's very interesting. I have never seen Rinpoche compulsively eat anything. Never.
I've
in 20 years.
No,
but I've never seen him compulsively eat the way Americans do. You know, like we do. I do. But it's interesting. Anyway.
So if you eat compulsively, Michael, if you compulsively, you break the vows?
We're going.
When you're in a meditative state, allowing your mind.
No, but then you remember that Jetsun Kapa said at the end, keep this ultra today. Don't just apply it to your formal meditation. Protect your mind throughout the day, because being compulsive during the day will make your mind less aware, less concentrated, and then you'll slip and you'll break another vow. Okay, anyway. You break them out, Yuri, I don't know. Where's the last word?
Fifth, man.
The antidote here is very, very simple. It's to respect the Buddha and respect the vows that he gave. Now, I think it's very important to say, and the texts are pretty clear about it, you normally start to respect someone when you start to get benefits. You know? Like if someone was your teacher, like I remember I had a teacher in 11th grade, okay? And that teacher taught me to write, and I know who it was, and I know what they did, and they beat me up, and yelled at me, and they made us write like 20 pages every single night for a year, and check them all. And so, I respect that teacher because I know the benefit I got. And it's the same with Buddhism. You know, you're not going to get respect for the Buddha or for the vows by trying to be respectful. It doesn't work. You know, try to act, you know, oh yeah, I know. It won't work, especially with Americans, you know. I mean, it's empty. It doesn't mean anything. Just to look good. To look respectful is one thing, but if you realize that you've got something out of it, you know, I mean, and this doesn't happen for a while, because first you have to try it, but if you're keeping the vows, and then after a while you start to have some extraordinary things happen, then what?
You really appreciate it.
You'll really appreciate and respect them, and that's the idea here. You know, follow them enough to see if somebody really helped you in your life, and you had your own people, I don't know who it was for you, but everyone in this room had two or three people in their life that they owe a big debt of gratitude. They taught you something invaluable. And you, when you meet that person, that's respect. The way you feel towards that person. And you know who it was. And you know what respect feels like if you think about that person. And just have that towards the vows. You won't get respect artificially. It has to come from having gotten some benefit because you kept them. And then you start to respect them. And you start to respect the Buddha. So if you want to get the antidote, it's respect from getting results, and obviously it'll never happen if you don't try them, okay? And you never will respect them. Okay, we're overrun, so I'm not going to do the last homework question. The last homework question is: what are the 5 temporal benefits of keeping your vow? And what's the one ultimate benefit of keeping the vow?
Well, but I want to know the advantage.
I mean, the advantage I keep hinting to you all night or saying directly to you all night, you will reach a different plane of existence called enlightenment. And you will reach a thing called paradigm. And just try it. You know, we can argue about how long it takes. Why don't we do it the opposite way? Keep it for a while. See if anything happens, okay? If nothing happens, check back with me. You know? But there's this big thing in Buddhism that people don't get any results, so they blame the vows or they blame Buddhism. And then the Lama says, well, did you keep them? And they say, well, what do you mean? Are they supposed to keep them? You know? But the people who don't get any results are the people who don't do anything. And then they get mad about that kind of that particular path without even having practice. So that's where the ultimate benefit is that. And I might as well say, just keep your vow, and you check it out, and things will happen. Okay, temporal benefits, I mean, one of the biggest ones is you can die happily. If you've ever had a near-death experience, one of the things that comes up first in your mind is regret for anything you did bad. And if you're keeping your vows, you just die very, very smoothly. You know, you got nothing to hide, you got nothing hidden, you got nothing that you didn't confess, and you just die very nicely. And you die looking forward to meeting Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. You got nothing to worry about. You're clean. That's why Adi Shah used to get off his horse every few miles and confess, you know, while students are standing there waiting, you know. And the Lama is getting off his horse and confessing because he doesn't want to die with these things on his conscience. You can die very nicely. They say the Buddhas will take care of you. They watch you with even more care. They keep coming to you. And you can look into the future life and see that you're not going to have any problems. And you will in your future life. And this is an experience which you will see directly at a certain point. You will not suffer anymore. You will have You may have to come back a few times, but those lives will be very smooth. You will always be well off. You'll always have enough to eat. You won't have any kind of serious problems. You'll be able to have enough to share with other people. And it'll always be like that. And you'll have a point in your practice where you can see that directly.
So are you saying that you will see emptiness directly then?
That's what enlisted, but I mean...
If you see your future lives, that's...
Right, after you see emptiness directly, you can see these. And you can see that you will not have... You will have, like, seven future lives. You will become a Buddha after that. During those seven lives, you'll be comfortable. You'll be having enough to eat, sleep, be able to share things with other people. You'll be in that top 1% of all the humans on the earth who have enough and plenty, and they share it with others, and you will reach that state. If you keep the vows, this is one of them. So that's it. That's the Bodhisattva vows, but you have to keep them. I can't do it. Yeah.
Did you just imply that?
It's in the reading. You check the reading. They're there.
Okay.
I did most of them. I did the important thing. But keep them. And we have a good opportunity. One is we're all new. You know, like people who've had them three times before and who heard them all three times before, I've noticed that they're the people who are least likely to change. It's when they're fresh in your mind that you actually change. So do it now. Do it now. And then use the other people in this class, for example, or whoever. But we're in a good situation. I know Kylie. He helps keep me straight at work. You know, when I come in and say something stupid, he rarely helps me to remember my vow. And that's a good thing. And what I'm saying is do it for the other people in this class. It's actually part of your vows. It's actually part of your responsibility is to now help each other. You know, we're in a nice situation because we're all trying to keep them, and then we all know that we're all trying to keep them. So we can help each other. You know, and when you see one of your Dharma friends slipping, you help them. And you say, yes, remember number 44, you know. And don't say it in a bad way, and don't do it in a nasty way, but do it in a helpful way. And then help each other. We're in a very extraordinary situation where we have a whole group of people trying to keep the vows, and we all know we're trying to keep the vows. So we can... We can keep each other straight. We can help keep each other straight. I mean, you can help me, especially, I request, openly and seriously. Okay?
Shall I miss you?